show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we are, about 2 minutes past the hour. We begin another week of conversation radio here on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go for the listen live button. That's where you go to hook up with the chat room. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chat room. It is, of course, also where you go to help keep this all afloat. And yes, we're in a hole. And yes, that hole is in excess of $300 deep. And, well, August is coming to its rather quick end. This is the 26th day of August, and we are sweating. We're sweating the end of the month, as we almost always do. Bills are coming due that could actually mean that we won't stop having shows because I've gone on the road, but because the bills ain't paid. So we got to get up above beyond $300 this evening, and that'll put us a little closer to just being able to do the regular evening's fundraising on any given night for the remainder of the month. PayPal button is there at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. So too is the traditional mail address. That address, of course, is The Horn, 1038. North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801. And thanks to those of you who use the PayPal button, and thanks to those of you who use the traditional mail as well, because both of them, in combination, literally have kept this on the air for as long as it has been. And yeah, it does get scary. And that's just the reality of trying to run radio without delivering you into the tender mercies of people who want you to buy gold now. There's never been a better time to buy gold. Gold is your surest hedge against inflation. Buy it high and sell it cheap, because we're pretty sure you're suckers. Buy gold now. Use your gold to buy a vacuum cleaner that'll pick up a bowling ball and drop it on a Swedish mattress where you lay supine while you wait for our herbal remedy to give you an erection and more hair on the top of your head. Buy gold now. That's how it goes. So, there you have it. We recommend the TuneIn Radio app for those who want to bring the program in via wireless internet on their tablet or smartphone devices. TuneIn Radio. There's a free version, and then there's a pro version. I like the pro version myself, but it's like $1.99. Oh, well. But it is. It's the beginning of the week, and my God, just the flood of morons is like the, I don't know, it's like water pouring through a breached hull of a giant and ill-fated ship. Because, yes, you realize this isn't just Monday. Oh, no. Oh, hell no. It's Moran Monday on the Horn. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up. Step right up. Behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas, you will hear right-wing morons, crazy morons, violent morons, self-important morons, morons of the teabagging variety, the John Birchin variety, the religiously fundamentalist variety, morons all. You can't tell the morons without a program, and this is the program that tells the morons you just can't tell them much. For less than 5 cents an hour of programming, yes, the Moran experience is yours. Upon entering the Moran Monday tent, we do advise patrons to hang on to their wallets and or purses and or small children, as the Morans, being right-wingers, quite often can get grabby. Head for the hills or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I got lots of Morans. Can we start with a cultural Moran? And I'm not going to bother you with audio of this. I awoke this morning because I'm getting up early these days since Ferg has to get off to school. I awoke this morning to see Mika Brzezinski having a poop hemorrhage over the MTV Video Music Awards. And lo and behold, there was Joe Kosutis, Scarborough, having a conniption right beside her. If they had declared it the old fogey geezer hour, it couldn't have been any plainer. The faux outrage of those two people over Miley Cyrus's not exactly impressive performance at the Video Music Awards, it showed them for the for-profit, multimillionaire anachronisms that they are. Gee, neither Joe Scarborough nor Mika Brzezinski understood that for-profit broadcasting in which they participate is designed solely and exclusively to generate money, and that perhaps the rather faux lascivious performance of a 20-year-old former Disney pop star would play right into that model? Excuse me? Yeah, they showed the video of Miley Cyrus last night at the Video Music Awards, and you know, she was kind of looking a little bit like Gwen Stefani, behaving a little bit like Madonna. There were the invariable references to Britney Spears. Oh, for heaven's sakes. I mean, I'm sure that 20-year-old Mika Brzezinski never did anything even remotely sketchy while she was busy being a student up at Williams College in Williamstown. Oh, perish the thoughts. And you just know that Scarborough never did anything stupid when he was being a frat boy down to the capstone at the University of Alabama. Roll Tide, roll! No. Both institutions being absolute models of rectitude. Rectitude damn near killed him. Sorry. Neither of them were ever actually young. Perish the thought. But my favorite conniption came from Flush Flimball. You remember Flush Flimball, street drug abuser. Flush Flimball, carrier of illicit Viagra prescription to the Dominican Republic, a country known for its little boy prostitution. You might recall that would be Flush Flimball, who went with his Viagra prescription to the Dominican Republic in the company of nothing but guys, you know, to play golf, nudge, nut, wink. Yeah, I got your mashy niblick. Hey, Rush, I think I got a little kid over here who can make you putter flutter. Yeah, hey, Rush, he'll give you a hole in one. Whew. Flush Flimball said of Miley Cyrus, "My friends, it was pure, unadulterated rot. It was just this side of onstage pornography." And if any of us have channeled our inner geezer on this and forgotten that the for-profit media serves to make a profit, no matter how, no matter how tasteless, no matter how licentious, no matter what you do. Please, remember how Elvis was only allowed to be shown from the waist up because of those snake hips? How they called him Elvis the Pelvis? Or how Jim Morrison was a threat to the moral fiber and continued existence of the United States? Yeah. Or how Lenny Bruce was hauled off in handcuffs from time to time for saying dirty words in public. Or, I think Jim Morrison was arrested in Miami for taking, well, getting a little close to, or actually naked. I don't remember. I was, you know, 4 at the time. But we've got that. The seemingly bottomless ability of the for-profit media to generate faux outrage. It just got me to thinking about all the hypocrites through the ages, the hypocrites of ancient Greece who hauled in an old epileptic man who walked around asking questions like, what is truth? Handed him a cup of poison and said, oh, you know, Socrates, our Athenian democracy here has decided that you're corrupting the youth and you've blasphemed the gods, so drink up, buddy. Yeah. But there is a little humor here, because I got to thinking to back in the day, about 5 years ago, I think it was, and I remembered something I had seen on The Onion. And we may have to start saying peace be upon them when we mention The Onion, because this qualifies, this is 2008, and this qualifies as, sure enough, not kidding, prophecy.
This week, the New York Times will run the first in a 6-part series examining America's overuse of Hannah Montana star Miley Cyrus. Most experts now agree that at current usage levels, Miley Cyrus will be drained dry of entertainment value by 2013. Joining us now is Miley researcher Dr. Justin Canty from the Institute for Sustainable Cyrus Use. Doctor, you say this is the worst entertainment crisis humanity has ever faced?
Absolutely. Miley is a potent entertainment resource, but we are overusing her at unprecedented levels. She's on television, albums, toys, clothing.
Okay.
She has a sold-out live concert series. If we don't act now, the down-to-earth Miley, who likes text messaging with her friends and playing guitar in her bedroom, will be wiped off the earth forever.
You point to the examples of Lindsay Lohan, Britney Spears, the Olsen twins.
Well, they were bountiful entertainment resources that our overconsumption reduced to smoldering remnants. But we are burning through Miley at a far more aggressive rate.
Then what is the timeline here?
Typically, a teenage star can have profits drilled from her for approximately 6 years before dropping down to is she too wild levels. Miley was discovered only 3 years ago, and already there's pregnancy rumors, the photo scandal.
However, though, Disney says it has plans to pump songs and shows out of Miley for at least another 3 to 5 years before discarding what's left of her.
She won't last that long. Within 2 years, she'll be little more than a withered, desiccated husk, incapable of causing anyone any amusement at all.
So what are the consequences if we don't cut back on our Miley use?
As Miley entertainment becomes more and more scarce, the millions of families across the world that have grown dependent on it will begin to fight for it or hoard it. Society as we know it will fail to function, governments will collapse, humanity will be reduced to roving tribes of barbarians constantly searching and fighting and scouring the landscape for the last remaining Hannah Montana fashion doll or the Best of Both Worlds CD. Incidentally, that is the future that's depicted on the cover of my new book.
A bleak prospect. Dr. Justin Canty of the Institute for Sustainable Cyrus Use. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up, an earthquake wiped out Etch-a-Sketch-a-Stan today.
Yeah, that's downright prophecy. But of course, we the email rolls in from Ron and Raleigh. Really, Bob? This is rock and roll for Pete's sake, or what passes for it. This is not Lawrence Welk. They really expect propriety at the VMA? Yeah, especially when it's a duet between Miley Cyrus and Robin Thicke, who has been promoting a video that involves a statement being painted on a wall that Robin Thicke has a big and something that rhymes with thick. Good God. I hope they were able to calm Mika down later in the day, a little Thorazine dart in the neck or something. And I don't know what you do with Limbaugh. You give him another pill and tell him to go and torment his wife in the pit or something. It puts the lotion on its skin. Marty noting, Bob, I didn't bother clicking on the Miley Cyrus link even while I was reading salacious entertainment news on the IMDb. I had no choice. They played it for me on the Morning Joe. And this is Moran Monday, and we're not going to spend a lot of time with this goober, but if disgraced Navy former Navy chaplain Gordon Klingenschmidt is having a hissy about Madonna, and he is.
To discern the spirits that are inside a person, whether they're full of the Holy Spirit or full of the devil, all you've got to do is look at their morality. And so let's take a moment and examine some of Madonna's lyrics. Here's a portion of the song, which she calls Revolver, and I'm going to read some of Madonna's lyrics from that story. She said, "My body's fully loaded." By the way, I'm not going to sing this, so I'm going to spare you. "I've got more ammo. Line them up. Knock them down. It looks to kill. If looks to kill, excuse me, if looks could kill, E-O-E-O, you're an accessory to murder, because my love's a revolver. My sex is a killer. You want to die happy?" Again, she says, "My love's a revolver. My sex is a killer. You want to die happy?" All right, now I've highlighted some of the yellow words. She talks about killing. She talks about murder. Talks about sex, talks about death. And I'm just quoting her words. Those aren't my words, those are her words. So I'm wondering now, if we apply the Bible and we discern the spirits inside of this woman, is she full of, and has she consented to, by a voluntary act of her will, has she consented to a demonic spirit to rule in her body? Well, to be fair, we have to analyze this from a biblical point of view. So let's take.
I'm as far as I can. I have to stop the clip. I have been begged not to interrupt the clips. I'm trying. I'm really trying. He's out there discerning spirits again, Gordo is. And he doesn't even have. Gordy doesn't have Jordy's little face bar glasses for all the discerning. By the way, he also highlighted the word body in that Madonna lyric. And he's going to discern whether she's, well, you know. Oh, say it, Gordo. The power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you.
Take a look at the Bible. The Bible says in Proverbs chapter 7, 21 through 23, "With her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him."
Wait a minute. Do you hear him kind of choking up? That's like the third time he's done it. Somebody throw him a tissue, will you?
"She goeth after her, he goeth after her straightway, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks."
In other words, the Bible is as full of violent imagery as anything Madonna ever wrote. But anyway, Gordo, Chappie, Klingenschmidt, bless you, it says that Madonna is possessed by demons. I can't wait to find out what Gordo Klingenschmidt thinks of Miley Cyrus. Because that's pretty much got to be one for the ages when that one comes around. Jim noting no one had to watch the MTV Awards. That was the Video Music Awards, actually. On PBS was a 3-hour documentary on Sir Winston Churchill. Much better visual fare. I'm sure it was, but try to convince a 17-year-old that you're right. It would be nice if we had 17-year-olds who would rather watch a documentary on Churchill. But it ain't likely. So, yes, once again, we find out in the year 2013 that, just as has always been the case from time immemorial, that when young people become old people, they get cranky and crotchety and start worrying about what the young people are up to out there with their flapper dancing or their jitterbugging or their the satanic Lindy Hop. Oh, my goodness, the culture is going to hell. Kate, who just stepped up and kicked in the first badly needed infusion to keep things going this evening. Thank you, Kate. Said, and this shit is important. Why? There are so many more important subjects to explore. Plenty of MORANs, starting with the entire Defense Department, those who want to bomb the hell out of Syria. God, my head's about to explode. This is madness. Kate, about to go on mute. Ah, fair Kate. Don't go to mute. This is MORAN Monday. And like we say, we've got them from all over the MORANosphere. Lord, I'm sitting here looking at just MORAN after MORAN after MORAN. But it's always fun to get started with a little bit of light moranity. Things like for-profit media millionaires making hypocrites of themselves, for instance. Ah, let's see, who else is a moran? Oh, TEPCO's a moran. But we knew that. Oh, here's a moran! Ha! You know what I like on the weekend? A little bit of shining, supercilious, white privilege. Particularly George Will. Yeah. Who knows where the real troubles are and what the real dangerous rocks upon which our ship of state might find itself foundering are. Tell us, George.
Also, for a little girl, I was not yet 4 when I watched it at home with my grandmother, who was...
We are talking here, of course, what Donna Brazile is talking about is the March on Washington, the 50th anniversary of which was celebrated this weekend. You'll know the 50th anniversary is later this week. So Donna Brazile was at home.
Yeah, but it was also...
She watched it with her grandmother. But wait, there's George Will is in the room.
So for a little girl, I was not yet 4 when I watched it at home with my grandmother, who was with us. And to hear those words, free at last, free at last, and to believe that at some point life would be better, that things would change, and to have witnessed the amount of change I've seen in my 50-plus years, it's amazing, it's incredible. And yet, if Dr. King were alive, he would still be marching today. Marching to raise the minimum wage, to ensure that workers could organize, he would be marching for the same values that he marched for 50 years ago.
No question about that, right, Byron?
Yeah, without a doubt. In talking to John Lewis, he talks about how the dream still lives, that only the down payment has been made. He, very focused about jobs. But there was also an optimistic spirit to Congressman Lewis and to Andy Young, men who were there. And they talk about, for instance, that while those numbers are real about employment, about poverty, one number, for instance, in 1963, there were only 365,000 blacks who had a college degree. Today, there are 5.1 million. Consider in 1963, you all could have treated us like dogs. Donna and I, it would have been okay. Nothing would have happened to you. Well, that's changed in America. And so for those men who were there, who bled, they see tremendous progress.
And they're right. They're right. I mean, having grown up in the Deep South in the era of Jim Crow, the difference is dramatic. And the fact that Andy Young was mayor of Atlanta and John Lewis is a member of Congress from Georgia is a great testament to the fact that when you do something like pass a voting rights bill, that it makes a difference, which is why, at the moment, what's going on about voting rights is downright evil.
Well,
because that really needs to keep going forward, not backward.
You know, we remember that day for the speech and for the the size of the crowds and the peacefulness of it. We forget that this was the March for Jobs and Justice. When Life magazine did its cover after this, they didn't put Martin Luther King on the cover. They put Randolph and Bayard Rustin on the cover. And there has been tremendous progress. There's no question about that in all the ways that we are talking about. But the persistence of the gap between white wealth and black wealth, white income, black income, is something that has stayed almost constant for the last two decades.
The gaps to which you refer were foreshadowed by something that happened 8 months after the march. 8 months after that, a young social scientist from Harvard, working in the Labor Department, published a report. His name was Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He said there's a crisis in African-American community because 24% of African-American children are born to unmarried women. Today it's tripled, 72%. And that, not an absence of rights, is surely the biggest impediment.
You got that? Got the memo, everybody? Okay, yeah. So you can just stop working on equality. You can stop working on civil rights issues, and we certainly, because see, all of that was that line of pernicious babble from George Will was aimed over at Cokie Roberts, who said the first intelligent thing she's probably said in decades when she noted that the voter suppression efforts that are going on, and she was referencing places like North Carolina, are evil. Well, here comes George Will to counter the idea that single moms, they're a bigger problem than essential civil rights relating to the potential ongoing viability of what used to be considered a republic. Well, it's those single moms who are the problem. You know, those food eaters. Those single mom food eaters. Morons. Morons. I mean, we can't have that Cokie Roberts saying something intelligent like white right-wing governments in North Carolina's trying to roll back the clock on the dream, that's evil. Oh, no, George Will is the smartest man in, well, America, or at least Washington, certainly a legend in his own mind. He can explain it to us, how the real problem is single moms in the African American community. Morons. Poor Randy. Randy from PA writing, I thought I was getting away from the entertainment news by tuning in, Bob, but I can't get away from it. It's taking over the city. Perhaps it would be a good time to take a repast. Now, where the heck are the 12 other men I usually dine with? Then this from Ron and Raleigh. When, I ask you, Bob, when is Bowtie George going to go to his long home? When? Let us quote the bar, devoutly to be wished. But the moranity, I guess there was just something about the marking of the anniversary of the March on Washington 50 years ago that just brought out the stupid by the bucket load. And as compared with this, the stupid of George Will is almost palatable, almost intelligent. Friends, neighbors, members of the Horn family commune, I give you Laura Ingraham remarking upon Congressman John Lewis. At some point. Someday. Working. Oh, for pity's sakes, let's try this again. Because you don't want to miss this. Because Laura Ingraham is she's a brilliant woman. Just ask her, she'll tell you. Yeah? She just wasn't comfortable at all with all those uppity people talking about rights and stuff like that. It's just intolerable. This is from today's broadcast, if we can ever get it to load on this ever-so-tired computer system. Yeah, while we wait, I think I'll go get myself a cup of tea. I'm kidding.
The tears of Trayvon Martin's mother and father remind us that far too frequently the color of one's skin remains a license to profile, to arrest, and to even murder with no regard for the content of one's character.
Martin Luther King III. The rally for the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech. It's the progress is really scant progress. And it's a license now to murder. Well, I would say if you're going to make that argument, then we better look at the crime statistics out there. You're going to make that argument, then address all of the arguments. Address all of the statistics on crime.
Teach the controversy.
All of the murder statistics. All of the violent crime statistics. Did anyone speak about this? I watched most of the rally. Garrett, I know Garrett watched all of the rally. Did anyone talk about the horrific crime rate in the black community? I don't think so. What does that tell us about what we've done to our families, what we've demanded as far as...
To our families? What are you talking about, Laura? Ingraham? Are you publishing Black Like Me sometime tomorrow? Oh, brother.
There's responsibility and discipline and behavior, self-respect, character. Let's talk about character. But it all comes down to just George Zimmerman? George Zimmerman. By the way, picked up this this theme was picked up by Colin Powell when he was on with Bob Schieffer in one of the, frankly, more disappointing appearances from Colin Powell.
What do you think the implications and the fallout of the Trayvon Martin case will be?
I think that it will be seen as a questionable judgment on the part of the judicial system down there, but I don't know if it'll have staying power.
Yeah. I'd be careful if I'm talking about...
Oh, wait a minute. Did Laura Ingraham just make sport of Colin Powell's weapons of mass destruction? These are not speculations. These are facts. Speech before the UN? I'll bet you if we went back in the Laura Ingraham archive, we could find her hallelujah-ing and hosanna-ing those very remarks as she beat the drum because Laura Ingraham wanted her some Iraq war. You know, because her hero, Dim Leader, had said, F Saddam, we're taking him out. But we're not there yet. Oh, no. This is going to take a little bit.
Questionable decisions. If I were Colin Powell, I mean, my goodness. This is George in Florida, line one. George, go ahead.
Hello. Quite an honor to speak to you. I'm a big fan. But,
thank you.
Unemployed history teacher.
Gee, I wonder why he's unemployed, seeing how he's calling Laura Ingraham. Well, and then the Nazis bombed Pearl Harbor. But they were eventually defeated by Lewis and Clark. Clark went on to found a dance program out of Philadelphia. Do me a favor. Don't ever, ever tell me that you're honored to talk to me like I'm some sort of freaking royalty. I'm honored to talk to you. I'm honored at least in one hand. Get the tennis balls. Get the duct tape.
I believe if he could have spoken at that rally, he would have told so many of the speakers that they had it all wrong. Martin Luther King really promoted a message of unity. And if you read his letters from the Birmingham jail,
letters?
Works, they promoted more unity. And this is a divisive speech that's being given now. It's a divisive word, bringing division. The Trayvon Martin, I mean, what about the baby they got?
No, it's just, it clearly, there's a duck in the background. Clearly what the goal was of this speech was to do what? The goal was, as our caller said, to divide. The goal was to co-opt the legacy of Martin Luther King into a modern-day liberal agenda, a left-wing agenda, progressive agenda, whatever you want to call it, from gay marriage to immigration amnesty was thrown in for good measure. We talked about the Voting Rights Act. I mean,
when everybody knows that Martin Luther King was just a sort of mid-20th century dark-skinned Santa Claus, that he loved everybody just like Jesus and Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. And he never said anything bad about America. Yeah, he never went to the Riverside Church and talked about all the evil, wicked, filthy, nasty, disgusting things we were doing in, Southeast Asia. No, he's just this harmless little black man who said we're all the same. And sang Kumbaya a lot.
We talked about issues that we're going to say now that Martin Luther King, who was pro-life, who was a Baptist preacher, was for gay marriage? Are we arguing that? Really?
I just love hearing a pasty-faced white woman define what Martin Luther King was all about, don't you? Because clearly she's an expert. He was a Baptist preacher. That means that he was just the same as, for instance, say, Jerry Falwell. You know, he's a Baptist preacher. I mean, if he was still here, he'd have a mega church and a couple of Gulfstream 5s and a Rolls Royce and maybe a Bentley and possibly a Ferrari and two or three homes and he'd probably have Christmas dinner with Willard Romney.
Well, he's not here to speak for himself, but I think it would be that's a stretch, don't we think? That's a real supposition on the part of the speakers. John Lewis actually addressed this issue of amnesty in his speech. Now, Lewis, of course, is known as himself as a trailblazing civil rights figure.
We must say to the Congress, fix the Voting Rights Act. We must say to the Congress, pass comprehensive immigration reform. It doesn't make sense that millions of our people...
Okay.
What? She inserted a sound effect of a bomb going off in the middle of audio from Congressman John Lewis. Some out there are interpreting that as a gunshot. It sounds more like a bomb to me. And this pasty-faced, doughy white woman, all aglow in her white privilege, has the nerve to say that she knows better than, say, the folks who knew Dr. King very well, including his son, including John Lewis, including Andrew Young, including Dr. King's wife, who said unequivocally that Dr. King would have been behind all for marriage equality. But Laura Ingraham is there, little wingnut. If you're out there lurking or anything, don't worry. Laura Ingraham is there to redefine Dr. King for you so that he won't be quite so frighteningly black anymore. Yeah, okay, Marty. Smart aleck. If the alternative is Ingraham, bring back Miley. No, we're done with both. But, Lord, a bomb? Really? A bomb going off? She blew up John Lewis? Figuratively speaking? Well, you're going to have that kind of thing in the for-profit broadcast world. If it's not Joe Scarborough... Waxing indignant over pop culture that he doesn't even remotely understand. Well, okay. It'll be Laura Ingraham telling out-of-work history teachers from Florida who are convinced that the message of Dr. King was unity. That Dr. King was really a secret right-winger. F. I've been waiting for hours to get this program started because it was just moron after moron after moron after moron. Seemingly without let up. Because many of you have sent me the story, I know that many of you already know the story out of Charleston, South Carolina, in which a group of people with dark skin were asked to leave a Wild Wings cafe because they, the dark-skinned people, were scaring by being dark-skinned people, not by sitting around waving guns in the air like a bunch of pasty-faced, doughy white people at a freaking Starbucks, but just by being dark-skinned people waiting on service, they were asked to leave because, well, there were so many of them that the white person was afraid. You know that story, I know. Whew! Little anniversaries like this come and go. And actually, this was kind of a big deal as far as anniversaries go. But they come and go, and as they approach and as they pass, it is as sure as the earth turning one side to face the sun, they will betray their inner clansmen. Maybe we, what do we call her? Klegel Ingram, Grand Dragon Laura, Grand Dragon Lady Laura. Got to get a little alliteration in there somewhere. Marty noting, you must remind Ron and Raleigh that evil is a preservative, and thus it may yet be a while before George Will goes to his long home in his narrow, entirely too tight Brooks Brothers cap-toed Oxfords. Aye, aye, aye. This weekend drove the wingers absolutely nuts. And in the chat room, Sparky is right. Oh, they're going to be screaming come Wednesday when Obama speaks. And you know what? It's true. And they'll probably hear him speak, and they won't hear any English. They'll hear him speaking in Kenyan. Sure, you know it. Busy, busy, busy. And just one last thing. If you thought George Will sounded really stupid, if Laura Ingram's lack of grasp of anything resembling American history has you gnawing at the tennis ball already, well, you may damn well choke on the tennis ball fuzz at this. The interweb tubes have been all abuzz over the fact that David M.C. Rove Gregory and his team of intrepid experts over at Meet the Prestitutes couldn't find anybody better to comment on this anniversary than, oh, damn it, just roll it.
And we're back here at NBC News. We're marking the anniversary of the March on Washington by asking you and others to share your dream by finishing Dr. King's famous phrase, "I have a dream that." We've received submissions from a wide range of people already, including Mitt Romney and the rapper formerly known as Snoop Dogg, now called Snoop Lion.
I have a dream that America's communities can be a safe home for our young men and women to achieve their life goals, that violence and hate will not be a factor on the streets, and we can all live in a world based on peace and love, no guns allowed.
I have a dream that what made America great will make our kids great, that superb schools, inspired churches, and parents that put their kids above everything else will lift our children and preserve the greatness of America.
Yeah. That really was Willard Romney. It really was. Snoop, okay. But the counterpoint to Snoop is Bishop Willard Romney? Huh? But then again, there is this thing. What did David Gregory say at the very beginning of this exercise in what the...
And we're back here at NBC News. We're marking the anniversary of the March on Washington by asking you and others to share your dream by finishing Dr. King's famous phrase, "I have a dream that..."
The only problem being that Dr. King actually did finish that phrase. I mean, it's not like James Earl Ray was hiding out in the observation window of of the Washington Monument and murdered Dr. King 5 years in advance, just as he said, I have a dream that, bang, you know, kind of like the boom that Laura Ingraham had. No, he finished. He finished the phrase. Why in the name of white privilege did David Gregory feel like it needed finishing? I mean, it's all there. Paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. And then he ups it, ups the ante by, oh, an octave or so. And he says, I have a dream today. I have a dream today. Which means it has left the realm of dream and has entered the realm of possible present, possible future. Of it has left the idea, it has left the realm of dream and myth and entered the universe of the real. But not for privileged David Gregory, who feels himself entitled to encourage a multimillionaire bishop to reinterpret the dream for us. And man, what a reinterpretation it was. Where churches are going to become regnant. Great kids? What does it mean to want a kid to be great? When Willard's own party is trying to compromise the ability of some kids' ability, compromise the ability of some kids to even have dinner, let alone be great. I have a dream that what made America great will make our kids great. That superb schools, inspired churches, and parents that put their kids above everything else will lift our children and preserve the greatness of America. Well, okay, how about that single mom who puts her kids first and therefore is unwilling to shuffle them off to daycare, if she can afford it, to go and work a minimum wage job at the Clown or the Thing or the red-headed pigtail girl hamburger joint. What about her? If she says, no, I would like to be able to raise my children and see them fed and teach them in the ways that I was taught, well, no, she's a welfare queen. She's a moocher. Because George Will thinks that she's a greater threat to the ongoing viability of this nation. Oh, hell. And what is that? What is that in Willard's comment? That superb schools inspired churches. I wonder who should be running the superb schools. Why, look, there's inspired churches. And parents that put their kids above everything else. Really, we're going to enter the conversation portion of this program in just a minute. And I would just love to know how you define what Willard... I mean, since Willard got to finish Dr. King's dream for him, let's figure out for Willard what he means when he says parents that put their kids above everything else. And what is that meaningless drivel about, I have a dream that what made America great will make our kids great? What is it that made America great? Well, look, superb schools, inspired churches, and... little bastard wants a theocracy. Of course, if you were listening to Dr. Bill, or if you listen to him tomorrow via the podcast, and you really should, you'll hear him further deconstructing a charlatan by the name of Cleon Skousen, who is the inspiration for the Beckerhead. He's a so-called Mormon intellectual. In the Reformed Egyptian, it says... But in the course of deconstructing Cleon Skousen, Dr. Bill observed that what this goob wants is actually 50 little theocracies in the United States. And that should be enough to kind of keep you awake at nights. That what made America great will make our kids great. Now, you could just treat that as a piece of throwaway political pablum. But I suspect if you were to... put a little sodium pentothal in what is obviously not Willard's hot beverage. Something like, put it in his milk or something. And you started asking him about what it was that made America great. Well, you wouldn't even have to use the sodium pentothal. He's happy to tell you. Well, what makes America great is me being able to be rich. And, some other 46% or so of America being dumb enough to support me while I get richer. And my buddies and stuff. Superb schools, insipid churches, inspired churches, and parents that put their kids, who will lift our children and preserve the greatness of America. Is it just because you and I are involved in the reality-based community that we understand that America's greatness is not something that needs to be preserved like some sort of Egyptian mummy wrapped in bandages and attended by incantations in Reformed Egyptian, but that America's greatness is always something that is just out of reach so that we can constantly be aspiring toward it, and that the people who can aspire toward it can be not only white folks like Willard, but persons of various hue, and not just googly millionaires like Willard, but people who don't have two nickels to rub together, that they have as great a part to play in reaching for that potential greatness of America, that they have as important a part to play, if not a greater, more important part to play in that aspirational reach than Willard Romney ever has or ever will. So your thoughts, please. You know the number. 304-658-3333. On the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, Bob Kincaid Horn. And yeah, if you want to include as a Moran nominee anyone who thinks it would be a lovely idea to bomb the snot out of Syria, you're not going to get any pushback from me. If you want to nominate anyone who thinks that having a new blood-sodden proxy war with the Russians is a good idea, I'll second the nomination. I'm wide open on this stuff. There are oodles of potential nominees. Oodles, I'm telling you. So give it some consideration and call in or email in bobkincaid@gmail.com or tweet in @bobkincaid. Or Facebook in, Bob Kincaid, your Moran Monday nominations as we go forward. We are $10 toward what is actually greater than a $300 fundraising goal for this evening. But 29 folks with $10 more each would go a long way toward sorting out the sweat factor as we get ready for September, and I get ready to be away from here for a little bit. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn.
Well, my daddy's in the pool.
stay mad at each other, they can't be mad at me. A modern classic from the Drive-By Truckers, Marry Me. Just, I don't know, there's a little resonance there. That touched on a whole several of the stories we got after. Thanks going out. Lots of thanks. Thanks to Ed. Thanks to Sal. Thanks to Karen. In conjunction with Kate, we are now at the $240 mark for our fundraising this evening. Y'all have knocked off a cool $60 in the first hour. And that helps more than you know. More than you know. 24 more folks at $10 a piece, and we can get this done for the evening and be a lot less scary for the coming month. Ed with a note. Thank you. Thank you, Bob. The Horn and Horn family continue to amaze me, and they make me a better person. Your friend, Ed Cofer. It's okay, he says, to use my full name. Thank you, Ed. Quick note in before I go to the phones, 304-658-3333. Quick note in from Randy in PA. You know, he says, I never got Willard's business model. I thought that there was something in business law that said that the management of a company had a fiduciary responsibility toward the shareholders. Yet all that seemed to go out the window under Willard's vampiric leadership stints. Sure, Bain Capital made boatloads of moolah, but what about the companies they oversaw? Well, they got screwed. But also, since they got bought, remember, when Bain Capital buys a company, the shareholders get bought out, and, you know, what shareholders? It's Bain's company now to treat as it sees fit. There's that phrase again, tender mercies. So, there you have it. If you can, join in with Karen and Sal and Ed and Kate. We'll get this all taken care of. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, I don't know if you'll say that when you hear my voice or not.
Hey, Bill, what's happening?
Oh, man, there's so much. That was interesting about Bain Capital. Let's just see, that's what an area... Never having taken business courses or business law, except business was something that I had to feel my way through. The TV repair business was something I had a good model because a friend of mine owned the biggest bunch of stores in the area, the repair shops. And that was an interesting thing, too. You know, he had phone numbers all over this Northeast Ohio area. Every small city, he had a number. And then the company, the telephone company, made him go put actual phones in people's apartments and such, so that the phone, the number that it had, also had a phone in that particular calling section, you know. And because he did me a favor. I mean, he's done me so many favors, and I let him come into an apartment I was living in and put an extra line in there for. So all these phone numbers that showed all of these places where you could bring your set, blah, 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 and they all terminated in one place. And so all the calls you made thinking you were calling somebody in your neighborhood, you weren't. You were calling somebody in the home base. A lot of repair guys did that. It looked like they had all these places, and they didn't have all those places. But the phone company did make you put a phone in there. So they got a little extra money that way, too.
Well, and the phone company is one of the... can you think about the years and the billions, if not trillions, of dollars the phone company made on long distance that cost them no more money than a phone call between two next-door neighbors?
You got it. Well, I actually am old enough to have had a party line at one time in my life. And you know, under the early 1950s... I'm trying to think of what they called it. Today they would call it welfare, age-dependent children, or whatever they called it in those days. You know, you weren't allowed to have a phone in the early 50s.
Really?
Oh, yeah. at least in this area, because, you know, my mother and father having a good divorce were, you know, the kids were the badmintons in the divorce settlement. That's how I ended up. They wanted me to take major work classes because I was I was gifted with the ability to read like a bandit. Before there was that high-speed reading, who was the woman behind that, Bob? You remember her?
Oh, Evelyn Wood, Reading Dynamics?
Yeah. I was born with that gift, with that luck. Of course, it was yanked out of my hands in, you know, the last 10 years, but, you know. Because the ability to read was the, at one point in time, was the American ability to learn something. How much, what college did Lincoln go to again?
Knox?
Yes. And Harry S. Truman, you know what the S stood for?
No.
Nobody else did because it didn't.
Yeah, right. It wasn't a name. That's what I thought. You had
it in there. You got it.
Did
yeah.
I miss something?
No, you got it right.
No, it does. His parents just worried that if he didn't have a middle initial, it would kill his ambition.
We wonder what, you know, this, when you see what's going on, like now it's, now we're going to go against Syria. We're going to hit them with everything in the, so we can go out and buy more missiles and the guys who supply the stuff. I sold electronic parts for a company in the 60s for a couple of years, an inside sales desk, and two of my biggest customers, one was General Dynamics, which I think was making, was there one making airplanes? And Goodyear Aerospace. And I'll tell you what, when he called, transistors had just, you know, the transistors in 1966 were not big. The integrated circuit hadn't made an appearance yet, the ICs. And these guys, when they were calling me to look for a thousand of a certain number transistor, I could always tell when it was a government buy. They never asked if there was a price break anywhere. You know, you bought so many, the price went down.
Yeah.
They did that. They just didn't care what it cost because, you know.
Yeah, but F-volume purchasing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The suckers were buying it. But we can't, but you weren't allowed to have a phone if you were on age-dependent children. I had a kid sick. Go to the neighborhood drugstore, use the phone there. Of course, in those days, you were lucky. You could call a doctor and they'd come to your house. Now I think they might come to your house if they thought they could collect their bill faster. But they would just stand there and hope they'd come out and they'd be up outside the door with their hand out saying, "Now pay that bill." And you know, that would be the extent of their house visit. Yeesh, you know. But I had a call with something I had just... I'm working on a copy of... book by Max Hastings for the third time, The Korean War. This is the beginning of it when they, you know, after the country was split between us and the Soviets, the price of rice under the Japanese had been held at a stable level. And one of the first things the U.S. people, the Army people, when they allowed the price of rice to float, you know. In other words, market prices.
The price profiteering?
Yes. The all of a sudden, the price went sky high because it was hoarding and buying huge amounts and, you know, sitting on it, whatever they could do, hoping the price would rise, and it went sky high. So that right after the war, say, 46, 47, the price of rice was hard for the peasants to be able to go out and afford. It
also keeps them hungry enough to... keep them from maybe rising up in rebellion, or?
Well, the guy from the north, Kim Il-sung, you know, the grandfather of the current president, that sounds like a real communist country to me. That sounds like something that Karl Marx would really admire, don't you think?
starving the poor?
Well, yeah, well, what the hell? The grandson of Kim Il-sung, the guy who invaded...
Yeah. Oh no. I know. Yeah.
Yeah. Does that sound like what kind of? I know General Yap, you know, Yap or whatever, the guy that beat the French and then us. He's about 100 years old. And he got up in the Parliament in Vietnam and he raised hell over some of the commercial things that have been going on in Vietnam. It's funny how that money really. Really changes a lot of people's feelings about this, that, and the other thing, you know. Yeah, so that was one thing I just thought I'd bring up. It's a real minor thing, but it's not a minor thing. If you were there and trying to eat, and it doesn't make the old man up there, Kim Il Sung, a better guy, because but the Syngman Rhee, the president of South Korea, who was he had a doctorate from United States schools. You know, he had stayed here so long and studied so long that he actually had a doctorate in something. I forget what it was. But I'm trying to remember when they finally got rid of that guy. It might have been, well, the war ended in 53 with armistice, and I'll bet you he was still there until maybe close to 60, 19. And he was an old man when he took office as the president of South Korea. And it's really funny. And the funniest thing was, we supplied the biggest thing we gave his army was 105 millimeter howitzers, no tanks. And of course, the North Koreans came down into South Korea driving T-34s. And the guys that were the first poor Americans that were pulled out of occupation duty in Japan. And now get over to Korea. And get over there. These guys will see they're fighting Americans, and they'll turn around and go home. So much for that idea, huh? Do you remember anything about how many people in that poor bunch never got back America?
Oh, hell, no. I mean,
I know the Vietnam era was, what, 57,000?
Thereabouts, yeah.
About, yeah. And it's the same old story. It's when I read that about how when the Americans took control from the Japanese, the price of rice, the staple commodity of their population, was allowed price-wise to float. Well, why not? You know, the capitalist system. You know, whatever you can get for it, get for it. And if they're hungry, that's too bad, isn't it? Then you wonder why there's discontent. What's your opinion on this Syrian situation,
Bill? I don't quite know what to say, because I'm anti-war.
Yeah.
And there's what is obviously a civil war going on.
Yep.
There.
You hit it on the nose. It's God Almighty. You know.
There's really not many good ways to intervene in a civil war.
Yes, you're always sticking you're walking right into quicksand.
Well, look, the chemical weapons issue was supposed to be the so-called red line, and all the nasty little chicken hawks are out there hooting for us to start slaughtering brown people in Syria.
Yeah, send out those missiles.
Right, and most of them, if not, if either almost none of them or none of them have anybody who is in harm's way of those missiles. And what happened the last time we intervened? Let's see. Yeah, we destabilized the entire region with Iraq, didn't we?
Yep, absolutely.
And now, this is not to say that Bashar al-Assad is some sort of nice guy.
He's a power mad. Take over from your father. Become a... the man you mentioned earlier, the last presidential candidate for the Republican Party, he makes his father look pretty damn good, doesn't he?
Well, his father was a liberal Republican, and until he came back from Vietnam and made that statement about how the generals had brainwashed him...
They were lying to him like crazy.
Up until that moment, he was leading Nixon in the 68 Republican run-up.
And I'll bet you a dollar to donuts. I was talking to my buddy tonight, the retired history teacher, the one who taught Steve LaTourette's kids. I was talking to him because he got a copy of that book I was looking for, the thing on the Balkan section of the war in World War One, that well-written piece about something that was important when it happened, because when they rolled through Serbia and Bulgaria quit the war, the back door to Austria was wide open. at that time, and it was that's not a strategically a good thing, you know, for the Germans on the Western Front. That your number, your biggest ally just said, I quit. I can't handle it. Yeah, there's all these sidebars.
Well, see, when we talk about Syria, and I mean, you know me by now, Bill. I'm a nerd. I'm a geek. And I'm a history freak. I'm a nerd. I'm a geek. I'm a history freak. That sounds.
Yeah, that was another World War One.
Well, that's what I was saying. You can't talk about Syria in 2013 without talking about the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire in 1918.
Yep.
Okay. Remember, what is now Syria was the French Mandate.
Yes, sir.
Following the First World War.
Yep.
And it only settled down when the Assads formed their version of the Ba'ath Party.
Yeah.
And brought some degree of stability to the country. Because remember, it was the so-called Arab revolts. What efforts? They were in Damascus before Allenby got there.
Yep.
There was a negotiated settlement about who would, but then thanks to the Sykes-Picot Treaty, they got sold out, and the French were given because. See, even with all the slaughter that had attended the First World War, whose first anniversary is barely a year away.
Yeah, 100 years.
Which is hard to believe. I mean, I've got photographs of my grandfather, the Doughboy, out there somewhere.
Oh, yeah, with that soup ball helmet and everything else.
Yeah, and and don't forget the leggings. And,
oh, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the Europe had not yet figured out that colonialism was not a good idea. So naturally, hey, look, one empire's fallen. Let's have another one step in. And hey, France, you can have Syria, and Britain will take Palestine.
Palestine.
And Britain took Palestine specifically because, as Barbara Tuchman laid out in Bible and Sword, the British have a long fetishized fascination with their relationship with the perceived idea of Israel.
Yeah.
And so that you know, the Syrian French part of that mandate is it's echoing down the corridor of the ages as a direct and proximate result of Europe's inability to grasp the idea that the white colonial era
was
coming to a bitter end.
Yeah. Yeah, that's our buddy Winston Churchill never could get that. He finally, I think, got it, but...
Churchill is generally lauded as some sort of a hero, but at the end of the day, he was a colonialist, royalist, racist, he was the last gasp of empire.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, the only thing that saved people like him was Adolf Hitler. You begin to wonder if these people didn't go out and hire this guy. You can stir the... And, of course, the Versailles Treaty was pretty low blow to the German people because of they wanted real gold or real francs and pounds. They didn't want German money and... So to keep the people going at home, my grandmother went to Germany in 1928 for a year and came back, and, you know, she brought 100 mark bills with her. I can remember going in to buy electronic
parts. Yeah, they were useless.
Yeah. Well, I was going in to buy electronic parts one time for the TV repair I handed in my life and buy some parts, and I hand the guy a 50, and he says, oh, the $20 bill of the future. And this, God, Bob, this had to be 1975, 76 when the guy said that. And I said, my God, I've got you thinking this.
Not that far off, though, when you consider, for instance, that that minimum wage that you and I have discussed, Bill, that was $3.35 in 1980 and is $7.25 now, that $3.35 in 1980 was worth $8.50 in today's dollars?
Yeah, it bought more because what was gasoline at that time... less than 40 cents a gallon?
Oh, 1980. No. It had seen $1. It was probably around 80 cents a gallon.
Yeah, about 80. Yeah, because I remember still buying when I had to quit driving in within a year after the 2 years after Bush's election, and I voted for the other guy, that wonderful liberal vice presidential man. Yeah, I voted
Mondale.
No, the guy that ran against Bush.
Gore.
And Gore's father was a boy. That was another guy with contrasting sides, wasn't there?
Sure.
Man, a guy. Because if you were a Southern politician in the 50s, man, here's the head of this pin. You dance on it.
And you know the same thing happens. The same thing can be said of Fulbright in Arkansas.
Yeah. Fulbright was a brilliant guy, and didn't he give away tons of money and scholarships?
Oh, sure. Yeah, and he had to be. He had to evolve to his position on Vietnam independently. But just based on the stuff that you're bringing up, where Syria is concerned, Bill.
Yeah.
I was reading some of the coverage earlier today, and for some reason, this phrase popped into my head as I was looking at Syria. And reading about how we're saber rattling, and you know we've sent a bunch of doing a little gunboat diplomacy.
Oh, yeah.
Why? My goodness, how long has gunboat diplomacy been going on in this country?
Well, it's one.
But this phrase popped into my head as I was reading about Syria earlier today, and I don't know. It came unbidden, but all of a sudden I found myself thinking, Syria, not worth the bones of one Pomeranian grenadier.
Ah, thank you, Mr. Bismarck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then again, neither was Iraq.
Yeah, exactly.
Neither was Afghanistan.
No, Afghanistan's been the graveyard for many armies. Didn't Alexander the Great have a problem there, or did he avoid it?
No. He had a problem there, only they called it Bactria. Wasn't that what they called Bactria back in the day?
Yeah, I think that was the name. It's been a long time.
Home of the Bactrian camel, the two-humper?
Yeah. Because I know the English had some problems, and they made a movie about that, The Man Who Would Be King or something like that.
Yeah.
What was the damn movie? I'm trying to think of the name of it. Steve McQueen and Candace Bergen were the leads. And it was written by a guy, a United States Navy man who had been a gunboat sailor. Sand Pebbles.
Yeah.
That's something that people should look at, because I used to talk to people and they'd say, well, what was wrong with that? I said, can you imagine a Russian gunboat sailing up and down the Mississippi and doing whatever it wanted to do? Or a German or whatever? Because there were so many of those. You know, every nation that had a gunboat had one on the Yangtze River, and you know, but well, they would.
And now with the revelations regarding the gas attacks, whoever perpetrated them in Syria, you know, we're saying, I guess we're inclined to believe that the Assad regime did it, whereas the Russians have said, no, it's obvious setup to discredit honorable Bashar Assad regime. Clearly, rebels have done this to make to draw in imperialist forces of the United States.
Oh, you mean Stalin and Gromyko are back to life? Jeez.
Well, I mean, come on. Vladimir Putin's an old KGB guy.
Exactly. And but they
he probably grew up worshiping Stalin's smelly old jockstrap.
Yeah,
I mean they hang on to shit like that in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, well, any of these backward. Well, Bob, when I grew up, they were still talking. When I was 10 years old, which was in 53 or so, Hitler was still alive somewhere. He was down in Latin America.
Oh, I was seeing that on the tabloids when I was a kid walking through Kroger's. You know, Hitler found alive in Argentina.
You too, and that was because. Well,
and there'd be this artist's rendition of a sketch of an old guy with white hair and a blunt cut, you know, a balding guy with a blunt cut Charlie Chaplin mustache.
Yeah. Well, I think he was playing tennis a few years ago with Elvis.
On Mars.
Yeah, exactly, you know.
Yeah, and Jim Morrison was the scorekeeper.
Oh, God, that's another one. That is a story that I was booked to do a job in Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Detroit, opening for Morrison and the Doors. And, I mean, I had a good booker in those days. The kid has a doctorate. He's probably retired from a college that he taught in Wisconsin. And straight guy. What a great, straight. I mean, I don't know about, I don't care about that. But when I say straight, I mean, he was one of the few people you'll ever meet in the music business, booker, who wouldn't pick your pocket with one hand, but he put $2 in the other. You know, those guys are booking agents. Oh, my God. But this stuff it's a wheel, Bob. The wheel keeps turning. And we keep paying the price for the evil and the errors that men have done before us. And the Middle East is one of them.
The Middle East is a hell of our own making.
Yes, sir.
I mean, I went back and did some research over the weekend because I've said something a couple of times and I wanted to check myself because it turns out I was absolutely wrong. I had said that the United States entered into an agreement with the Saud family in the early 20s, but it turns out it was right after the Second World War.
Yeah, it was after that.
I just happened to be looking into that gang of regal thugs. Because I just happened to run across a story that in the fairly recent past the fine, upstanding, civilized royal family of the Saudis had decapitated an Indonesian woman because a child that she was the maid for had died while in her care. She had never had a child of her own. She knew nothing about child rearing. Buckus.
She was a hired hand, yeah.
And so the baby died, and the Saudis lopped her head off and made sure to make. I mean, they made damn sure that there was video of it out there. You know, one stroke of a sword. You know, goodbye now. And it was either Malaysia or Indonesia, and the ambassador was called home. And a lot of bad blood, and travel was forbidden to the kingdom.
Yeah, they kept a closed house there for a long time. I know a fella that was a landlord of mine. He'd gone over there and set up hospitals, which was his place in industry, was to go over and help set up medical facilities, buildings and such, you know. And he had talked to me a little about that. It's amazing the people you meet as you rub shoulders, you go through life, and you bump into some guy. I remember I was working at a place, and I had a book on the Korean War laying there, because I used to read at lunchtime. And this guy says, I graduated at West Point with Walton Walker. I said, oh, really? Good, you know. I mean, it's a small house.
Yeah, but the thing is, had we not made various messes of the region, and by we, I mean...
Well, the Western states.
Yeah,
we didn't have too much to say about it after World War One. We were still ducking back to the house again. Back in, we had made enough money.
Right, but the thing is, half of the things that seem so geopolitically critical now wouldn't be. I mean, there was the same vengeful urge that was turned. On Germany following the First World War was also directed to the Ottoman Empire, which actually only surrendered after Germany had surrendered.
Yeah, because they spent most of their blood battling the Russians in the Caucasus.
Yeah, well, and then you know there was the business of the Arab Revolt.
Yes, yes, the revolt in the desert. Lowell Thomas wrote that, the old newscaster, didn't he?
Oddly enough, I went down the internet rabbit hole over the weekend and wound up reading a good bit on Lowell Thomas because I actually went reading after Lowell Thomas because I got to thinking about how he had sort of invented broadcast media.
Yes, yeah, he really did, yeah.
And so out of a matter of sort of professional curiosity, I read, and you can't read about Lowell Thomas without running across T.E. Lawrence.
Yes. Yeah, that was The Revolt in the Desert. Was that what he called the book?
With Thomas in Arabia.
Oh, is that what it was called?
Yeah.
It's been so long since things just... my dad used to say, one of his pet sayings was, the more things change, the more they remain the same. He would use that. And,
sure.
Of course, I was too young. I'm trying to figure, what the hell did he just say? I didn't know any
better. But, Bill, the question is, what do we do about Syria?
What the UN was devised to do? Wasn't that what the whole idea?
Yeah, and Russia sent out this little note earlier, I think yesterday or today, saying, if the United States does anything with Syria without UN approval, it will be illegal act.
Well, let me.
And what the, you know, what that means is, if you convene the Security Council to do anything about Syria, we're goddamn sure going to veto it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Korean situation, the Russians had walked out of the UN in protest over the fact that Tanker Jack got the seat of China when he was sitting on Formosa, looking behind him to see if he still had his ass. He had his pockets full of money that he stole from China on the way up, plus what he got from us.
So since it would appear to be a full-on proxy war, shall we just go ramp it up and have a little Spanish Civil War for the 21st century there?
Here we go again, huh?
I mean, I really think this is one of those nice moments where the best thing the United States could do would be to, let me see if I can put this succinctly, mind our own business.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really? Honest to God, do something like that when we've got it? I mean, we all know everything's beautiful.
Look, the Saudis are the BSDs in the region, okay, among the so-called Arab states.
Yeah.
The Israelis would really prefer to see the Syrians remain somewhat stable,
yeah,
so that some crazy bastard doesn't come roaring over the Golan Heights.
Yeah, exactly.
And the thing is, like the Lindsey Grahams and the McCains, and, oh, we need to stop all aid to Egypt. Well, okay, we'll do that, and guess what's going to happen? Then the Saudis will, because the Saudis can double what we're giving.
Yeah, they can.
And, we're just trying to buy influence. We're trying to throw money at the problem and hopefully get listened to somewhere along the way because, one of those ancient bugaboos is riding our butts there, Bill, because we wouldn't give 2 cents about Egypt but for one thing, and you know what the one thing is.
Well, peace with Israel.
No, the Suez Canal.
Oh, the canal, yeah, of course. I forgot about the canal. Is it big enough to get some of these ships through it today? I guess it's...
Yeah, I mean, yes.
Better than the Panama, then.
Well, it's... it beats the hell out of going around the Horn of Africa.
Yeah, that's what it does, yes. That's why they put it there. I mean, I remember reading a book on that when I was... Jesus, if I was 11 years old, I'm surprised. Ferdinand, what was his name? I can't pronounce... I don't use... that is the source point of a lot of obscene jokes. I don't speak French, so I don't know what Ferdinand was this. Because there was a good book on the building the canal, and it was the two big canals, Panama and the Suez. I almost forgot about the Suez because I haven't heard the name. Well, 1956, there was the French and English went to war with Egypt over the canal, didn't they? They landed paratroopers there?
I do believe so, yeah.
Yeah. I only remember what I saw in the paper. And, I hardly... If I didn't listen to a football game, I don't know if I'd believe the score they give you.
Let's see, it's been enlarged repeatedly. It is 193.3 kilometers long, 24 meters deep, 205 meters wide, and... that'll get a good bit of shipping through.
Yeah, I think it would.
And we maintain it in the best interest. We maintain it not in the best interests of ourselves, but in the best interests of Europe.
Yeah.
Because the oil, in order to get timely from the Persian Gulf to Europe,
needs the Suez Canal?
The canal. See, I thought it was kind of a... It's built differently than the Panama. There's something about the geography or the land or whatever that was made it somewhat easier to dig. Whether it's more one level, how many? Is there a lot of locks on it?
I don't really know it, but the geography alone would. It was an engineering marvel of its time in 1869.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
But it just by virtue of climate and geography, it was not as much of a chore as the Panama Canal was.
Yeah, the Panama was a chore just from the health standpoint of beavers alone. It was. Well, there was a railroad track that ran across, I believe, Nicaragua at one point during the gold rush. Get those fools, you know.
But yeah, I just checked in. The Suez can handle shipping traffic that is larger than that which can be accommodated by the Panama Canal.
Good. I was just taking a guess based on what I knew about it, and I don't know everything. That's for damn sure. Years ago, if you asked me when I've been sampling the Tanqueray bottle, yeah, I know everything. Just ask me anything.
Right.
Ask me what the hell I'm doing here, drinking this poison. You know, I'm what the hell.
Of the super tankers can't make it through.
Okay, because the Suez, you know, was a big cause of combat in World War II. That's for sure.
And Marty tells me there are no locks on the Suez.
No locks.
Canal.
Okay. And
Sparky confirms no locks at all.
Yeah, because that was there's a certain type of canal, level or something they called it. I remember on my way to, I'll let you go after this, I was on my way to Toronto, and we went across the canal up there, and I look over to my right, and there's a big ship locking through, you know, part of the St. Lawrence Seaway. That was a wonderful idea for commerce, and that's why we have zebra mussels and a few other things in the Great Lakes now that we didn't have before.
That ain't supposed to be there.
Yeah, they ain't supposed to be there because the guys would blow their ballast, you know. And there's catfish pushing at a fence up around Chicago trying to get into the Great Lakes.
Marty pointing out, regarding Syria, we need to adopt Star Trek's prime directive and leave what appears to be a civil war unto the Syrians.
Yeah, let them deal with their own problems. I mean,
I think meddling in something like that is almost it's not meddling in it is harder is harder to do than meddling, because you've got all these brilliant people who were trained at your Yales and whatnot. So, oh, but Mr. President, you must understand that if the Russians are arming the government, well, the government will simply butcher the opposition.
Yeah.
And that just isn't sporting. It's certainly not according to Marcus of Queensbury rules.
Well, it's probably very true that people will do this. Humanity has done it. I don't care. You can substitute any nationality. My father-in-law, I just say, who fought on Tinian and Saipan and Iwo, he would fish with me late at night and said, Bill, I didn't like everything I saw done by Americans. He said, stuff happens when you're in that situation. And I said, yep. You lose all control when you see your buddies Joe and Sam and somebody else. Well, here we got this guy here. And the Japanese military, those fellas were trained not to surrender. I mean, it was, you fought until you were gone. That was that. And I'm glad that's over. I'm glad I didn't have to go to that. But because I just, you know, what the hell do you do, Bob?
Well, that's the thing that scares me about Assyria because we've still got right-wingers out there beating the drum. We've got to do something about Iran. And it's always a case of, come on, let's you and him fight.
Exactly.
Because, none of those precious Romney boys are ever going to don a uniform under the colors and go and protect freedom.
No.
No, hell no. And Lindsey Graham doesn't have any youngins to send off to war.
Yeah. It's the old story. I mean, some of the things I've learned through the study of the Civil War, those New York draft riots were pretty... And there were some... And, the Confederacy went to drafting men before the Union did. And,
Yeah.
So, do Do things ever change, or does the circle just keep going around?
Well, no, I think it does, because we make it we're making it harder and harder. The Iraq War was never generally approved of by the population of this country from get go.
But man, they sure didn't allow the anti-war movement that I was a part of, and I used to argue with people on the left, that I said, hey, from my standpoint, I was a little younger then. I said, I wouldn't get involved with it, because it ain't going to do you any good. It's going to do you a lot of harm. If there was good in it from the citizens of this country, at least there was some kind of logic. Twisted though it is, and wrong though it may be, if we took in a lot of money out of it, that was okay, you know. But that's what bothers me so much, and I wish Dr. Bill would speak a little bit about Hamilton's idea of an economy and how he'd be really not happy with what.
Well, you need to bang out an email to him, and I'll bet you it could easily happen.
Because I don't know if I'm wrong or not, but I think Hamilton would be really upset with this stuff being built in different countries and sold here, and Americans being out of work because of it. Not that he was a great guy, it was just mathematics to him, maybe. Because the country was so young and new at the time.
Well, and he wanted to create an independent moneyed class.
Yeah.
Because he was very much a classist.
Yes, he was.
He felt, Alexander Hamilton was very clear in his, and I think he probably stated it more honestly than Madison did. Hamilton just said, listen, there's some people in this country don't have any business participating in the government. The smart people need to do that, and the smart people are the people with the money, or else they wouldn't have money if they weren't smart.
Yep. The so-called ruling class, I mean, that's the problem that...
Hamilton was an oligarch.
Yeah. The problem when you read, like I did as a young man, the Civil War, and you looked at the courage of the men wearing the uniform on both sides, the foot soldier. The guy out there, you know, with new weaponry that could kill you quicker and everything else, and medicine that hadn't even begun to take shape.
Oh, I think about that line. It was from, I mentioned that movie, Mate One. There's a line in there where the labor organizer, a fictitious character, he's kind of a composite, talks about being a conscientious objector or a resister of the draft in the First World War.
Yeah.
And labor organizer, Marxist that he is, he says, all I seen was workers killing workers.
Yeah, that's the whole bottom line, because they're the people, the lower social classes, socioeconomic classes, are the guys that have to carry that, lug that 58 caliber Springfield or whatever the hell they were carrying in the 1860s at that time, and they had to. But I do have a hard time with this simple thing, Bob. How one man, regardless of what he looks like or where he's from, thinks he can own another one. You know, and that's the thing that...
Oh, that bothered the hell out of Mark Twain, too.
Yeah. Certainly does. And we see it to today. I mean, only now the economic ownership is called the loan company, and what's those guys that loan money? The company that's named after the day you used to get paid.
Yeah.
Yeah, that bunch. I mean, that's usury. These guys, I think the guys at the corner, the guy at the corner bar who worked for the was a loan shark would be taken aback by these legitimate companies. This is legitimate. When I did it, they threw me in jail. What the hell?
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll let you go you mentioned this whole thing with this chronic and constant war in the Middle East, and if you go back far enough, you'll see how far the Ottoman armies went into Europe.
Oh, yeah.
How about Vienna twice in world history? They were at the gates of Vienna and all, and that's a long way from Istanbul, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a hike up the Blue Danube.
You got it. Anyway, you have a good one.
All right, you take care, Bill.
Take care, bye.
Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. History, Shakespeare said, what's past is prologue. And so I can't help but think we get a little bit better handle on, A, prognosticating what the eventual screwed-up response of our country will be to something like the Syrian civil war. Because, well, how much? See, that's the thing. We don't really have any oil interests in Syria, do we? Or does it turn out that there's something frackable beneath the Syrian sand? That'll be the ultimate determiner. Remember, I'm the one who said that we need a bill in Congress to change the national motto from "In God We Trust" to, I mean, it would make a hell of a lot more sense to put it on the money, "The business of America is business," Calvin Coolidge, than "In God We Trust." If "In God We Trust" is the motto, hell, why have money? But no, the business of America is business. And if it turns out to be good for business to rain agony, misery, and death on Syria, we'll make it rain. If it turns out not to be good for business, we won't. So, and remember, there's that little bitty hunk of Syria that actually comes all the way out to the Mediterranean. You ever wonder why that's there? Because the British had Lebanon and Palestine, and that was pretty much the Levantine seacoast, and the French needed some sort of an outlet to the sea, to the Mediterranean. So, yeah, there's a little bit of Syria that touches the Mediterranean, sort of between Lebanon and Turkey. Think beachhead. And just because, as noted previously, we are really, really sincerely not good at foreign policy, whatever the most wrong way we can possibly go will be the decision that we make. Yeah. Jim noting, the key to Syria rests with an agreement between the Russian Federation and the United States acting in concert. Neither country has beneficial interest in a prolonged civil war there, believe me. I don't doubt you, Jim, but I have my doubts about whether or not we will act that intelligently, because it's already a proxy war. And the question, really, the answer in Syria is the United Nations. This is the kind of thing that the United Nations was chartered to prevent or to stop in case it got going. But naturally, here in this country, we have, for about two generations now, had a bunch of numbnuts running around with bumper stickers provided by the John Birch Society, by the way, founded with Koch brothers' money, well, Koch daddy money, "Get us out of the UN." And as recently as last year, you had idiots proclaiming that they were watching for the blue-helmeted ones to come pouring across the Mexican border in an effort to seize Lubbock. Remember that? That was real. The UN could sort this problem out. The old colonial powers can't. The UN could. But we are absolutely... Imagine if we tried to sort this out via the UN, how many hissies would be had by the Laura Ingrams of the world. Oh, please. And the Limbaughs. And the O'Reillys. Or that Obama only wants to invade Syria so he can impose Kenyan-style socialism on the Syrians like he has here in what used to be the United States of America. He'll go over there and build Obama-style Kenyan socialist Muslim FEMA re-education camps. oh, sure, it's a broad brush. But you know it's damned well likely, too. So here we are at the close of hour number two. Oh, I had an email in from Granny T in Tennessee. Going back to Willard Romney finishing, I can't get it out of my mouth, finishing Dr. King's sentence for him. Granny T wrote in, "Hey, Bob, what the hell was Mitt Romney doing in 1963? I don't know. Please tell me. This is a real question, not one of my usual snarky comments." Well, Granny T, in 1963, Willard Romney had just helped his daddy get elected governor of Michigan, and for a time he was serving as an intern in his daddy's gubernatorial staff, and this is about the time that he goes off to Cranbrook, which was a boarding school, where he would then begin to torment other students for not looking sufficiently butch. You might recall the incident that Romney admits to, in which he tortured a young boy by putting him down on the ground and shearing away his hair. This is before he dodged the draft by going and trying to take the good news of reformed Egyptian to the French. In regard to 1963, Granny T says, "I know what I was doing, being called a goddamn redneck, white trash nigger lover. I turned 17 just in time to see JFK blown away. My brain demons are still running amok. Replays of November keep coming back. Good music, fun people, all the usual remedies, just, you know. Good thoughts to you and the Horn family, a place of refuge." Thank you, Granny T. Thank you sincerely. And a gentle reminder, nothing much rolling in since Karen kicked in at 7 minutes past the hour, and we are now at the beginning of the third hour of the program. We'll take a little break. Remember, the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. A little interlude, and then back with your observations, your conversation, your ideas, and in fact, your More and Monday nominations. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. Bill might enjoy this. A little historical music. With some damn fine guitar playing, too.
I'm here sitting in the wreck of Europe with a map of Europe spread out in a hall of a sign. Every single nationality and principality have come for a piece of the pie. I'm sitting in the wreck of Europe with a map of Europe and the lines and the borders are gone. Gotta do this jigsaw puzzle, it's an awful muddle, but somehow we gotta go on. Lawrence of Arabia is waiting in the wings. He's got some Arab sheikhs and kings and we're in debt to them somehow. Lawrence of Arabia has got this perfect vision, gonna sell him down the river, there's no time for him now. I think I'm gonna take a piece of Russia and a piece of Germany and give them to Poland again. I'll put together Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia and hope that is how they'll remain. Then I'll take a bit of Turkey, then a lot of Turkey, this is all quite a heady affair. Pressure around Iraq to pick up and this Churchill's hiccup and we can't leave it up in the air. Woodrow Wilson waves his 14 points around and says the time to act is now, won't get this opportunity again. Woodrow Wilson has his 14 points but Clemenceau turns to Lloyd George and says, you know that God himself had only 10. Carried by a league of notions, by a league of emotions, I don't think I quite understand. I only know from this commotion there's a chance that we could turn the world in the palm of our hands. I'm carried by a league of notions, by a league of emotions, I don't think I quite understand. I
I only know from this commotion that the trick is the time. We could turn the world in the palm of our hand.
For me to imagine, but that album came out 18 years ago. It was called Between the Wars. Al Stewart did it in conjunction with Lawrence Juber. And, well, if that period, the between the end of the First World War and the beginning of the Second, is at all fascinating to you, and if you enjoy great musicianship and brilliant lyricism, not a bad cut on the record. Naturally, it did not do well in for-profit radio. Damn shame. It's just a pity. Can you imagine that running on the for-profit radio where maybe some pimply-faced kid would hear about Clemenceau or Lloyd George or Churchill or Lawrence of Arabia and run off wondering who they were because the damn song was so cool and the music was so good? Yeah, can't have that. Instead, we get blurred lines. I'm a geezer. But, no, you get the idea. To the phones, 304-658-3333 is the number, and the Skype line is also open. Bob Kincaid, Horn. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey there, Bob. How you doing?
Hey, Jim. What's happening?
Nothing. Al Stewart, great musician, and a lot of content in his songs. I always liked that man.
If you've never heard this record, you would absolutely adore it, Jim.
I can remember the first thing I heard by him was, I think, Time Passages.
Year of the Cat came before that, but...
Or the Year of the Cat and some of the stuff. I mean, he was just a brilliant... The guy's an absolutely brilliant writer.
Well, I mean, just check out the name of some of the titles of some of the songs on this track. Night Train to Munich.
Right.
Age of Rhythm. Sampan. Making reference to Southeast Asia, Lindy Comes to Town, Three Mules, A League of Notions, which we just heard, Life Between the Wars, Betty Boop's Birthday, Marion the Chatelaine, Joe the Georgian, which is brilliant, a song about the Spanish Civil War called Always the Cause, a deeply disturbing little tune called Laughing into 1939, and it closes with an instrumental piece called The Black Danube.
Yeah, I remember one time, a couple of years ago, you played the song that he had written, I think, about the brown shirts and the Night of the Long Knives.
Yeah, that's off of another record. That's called The Last Day of June, 1934.
Uh-huh, absolutely. I was very impressed by that, and have always been an Al Stewart fan. I've always liked a lot of his stuff.
I ran across a fascinating interview with him in which somebody asked him, the interviewer, obviously, why do you write the stuff you write? And he said, Well, I rather figure that everybody's done. I'm in love with you. I hope you're in love with me. Let's be in love together.
Oh, absolutely.
So he said he would just write, and you know, he reads voluminously. He's also an enophile. So, you know, glass of red wine, good history book, notebook, and next thing you know, you wind up with League of Notions.
Well, he has a profound knowledge and interest in history, and uses his music and the lines written in his music to convey his feelings, which are very, very, very true, and extremely erudite. I've always had a great deal of respect for him. I really have.
He has a tune on, I think it's one of his later albums. It's a Beach Full of Shells or something like that is the name of it. And it is absolutely transcendent because it starts, Violet Asquith in 1915 was madly in love with the poet, help me here, Jim, Rupert
Murdoch? No.
Wash your mouth out.
No, I was just kidding. I'm sorry. I couldn't.
Rupert Brooke.
Rupert Brooke, absolutely. The English poet for whom my cat is named.
Exactly. And that's why I knew you'd be able to help. So it starts off with Violet Asquith, daughter of the Prime Minister, watching Rupert Brooke's ship sail away from Southampton.
Well.
But here's the fun part. It ends 90 years later, as the narrator of the song walks out the front door and picks up his newspaper in the morning.
Right. The trouble is, Al Stewart's lyrics are beyond a greater portion of the listening audience because, I'm afraid to say this, most of the people who listen don't even know who the hell or what he's talking about.
No, you're right, Jim, and it's kind of a difference.
I mean, they have no historical bedrock upon which to base their level of appreciation, in my opinion.
But it's a question of curiosity, because when it wasn't Rupert Brooke, it was Siegfried Sassoon. It was Siegfried Sassoon. I was just checking here.
Okay.
Somewhere in England, 1915 is the name of the song. But and that's what I don't understand, because I heard this music, and that's not to say that this is the only one, the only artist I heard and went and learned from. But it would send me running off either to the encyclopedia or the public library, and now it's even easier because look, the internet.
Unfortunately, most people don't even have the interest enough to even look up who Siegfried Sassoon was. As a matter of fact, the only mention of Sassoon would be that people might be
hair products.
Vidal Sassoon. You know, that's the thing, and that's going to be our really our denouement is not being able to look back and see what these people have done and what this guy's talking about and. That's always something that's always been kind of in the back of my mind. And as far as Syria is concerned, we were talking about that earlier, and you mentioned my email. Even though the UN, and by the way, I have UN flags and a wreath on my front door.
Oh, I know. I know you believe in the idea.
I do, absolutely. But because of the veto of the Russian Federation and the Security Council, I would hope, and I'm just hoping, that there's going to be some type of backdoor channel into Moscow in which we can, you know, develop some type of understanding about the importance of calming this situation down in the area of Syria, because there is just more than Syria. There are so many other nations that are connected to this thing, and That's a real tinderbox there over there. So I just hope that Mr. Putin might be able to work together with Mr. Obama. Of course, now, when you look at Mr. Putin and the people who are in control now, I mean, Vladimir Putin is is a virtual dictator of the Russian Federation now. I mean, he made it a point to come back as the second president, that type of thing, and there were a lot of people over there. I'm very unhappy with it. But I would have hoped, and here again, as Benjamin Franklin once said, hope dies farting, you know, that Putin would have sense enough to realize we don't need to be tweaking people's one another's noses over there, because it's just a very dangerous situation.
Well, a hell of a lot more than noses can get bloodied, Jim.
Well,
but,
I know.
But there's more and more cause to be worried about the dictatorial nature of Vladimir Putin.
I've got a
story out from a week ago, or a little less than a week ago, actually. A correspondent appeared on RT, and are you familiar with RT? It's the TV network that is run by the Kremlin.
Mm.
And they have said, you know, they've been sort of, you could tune them in and get some reasonably progressive viewpoints from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all over now, because one of their correspondents who would show up to talk about issues from time to time donned a pair of rainbow-striped suspenders during a live segment to protest the ongoing homophobia that is just burning across Russia now.
I remember that now.
And that journalist is of course gay, and he has now been kicked off of RT. He was actually brought on, and this is just weird. He was brought on because he had written an article. Oh goodness me, what was it called? Because he was the author of a piece called Bradley Manning Gets Off Easy. And in the light of that, he pulled on the rainbow suspenders, Jim, and claimed that being silent in the face of evil is something we can't do. Being here on a Kremlin-funded propaganda network, I'm going to wear my gay pride suspenders, and I'm going to speak out against the horrific anti-gay legislation that Vladimir Putin has signed into law, that was passed by the Russian Duma, that criminalizes homosexual so-called propaganda and that effectively makes it illegal to talk about homosexuality in public.
Yeah, that was definitely a step in the wrong direction for them to do that. I had hoped that perhaps with the dissolution of the former Soviet Union that things might change for the better over there, but apparently it would appear to me as though we're talking about some type of reaction formation there.
And well, when he left the studio, in the middle of his cab ride, the cabbie tried to kick him out of the car halfway to the Stockholm airport because he said that the RT had pulled the funding for the fare. But he wound up getting to his proper destination after all. But of course, RT is... went nuts saying, no, we didn't. We didn't try to inconvenience him, and we didn't drop him off on the side, have him dropped off on the side of the road.
Well, he'd best be very happy that the cab driver didn't take him right to the steps of the Lubyanka.
Well, he was in Stockholm.
Well, even on his way to Stockholm, you know, that type of thing. I'm sort of disappointed with what's happening over there with Mr. Putin and some of the people who are advising him. Of course, like I said before, all of these operatives and people who are in positions of power there are former people of the former Soviet Union. And there is a movement there among, I think, the Russian leadership to reestablish Russia's primacy, the primacy they enjoyed when they were the Soviet Union. I mean, they have, I think, never gotten over the fact that during the dissolution of the Soviet of the 15 republics of former Soviet Union, that they sort of became a second-rate power, and now there is the resurgence to reestablish that sort of primacy. In other words, they're looking back on the former days of glory and I guess the days of other Soviet leaders, to even mention Stalin, in spite of the things that Khrushchev had to say about Stalin in his secret speech, and I think it was 22 February of 1956 when the crimes of Stalin were exposed. And I had just always hoped, for the sake of the Russian people, that they would be able to establish some type of liberal, democratic, humane state, because they've been through so much by trusting people who were bloody dictators. I mean, if you go back into Russian history, I mean, let's face it, they've always had a history of very strong leadership and things of that nature, and some of the leaders were pretty good, some of them pretty bad, Stalin being the worst, and of course Khrushchev being a little bit better than Stalin. And, you know, I just hope that things had gotten better there, and people would be allowed to express themselves freely and to enrich themselves and to develop their own very rich culture, even beyond what it is right now. But that's just my hope for the Russians.
Well, I understand, and I think most people hope that, Jim. But the problem lies in the fact that with the fall of the Soviet Union, you merely had a transfer of, you had a sort of an oligarchic handoff. I mean, Moscow is one of the most expensive places on the planet in which to live now.
Oh, yeah. There are lots of Russian billionaires and people like that who are, it's just amazing how they have developed their own lifestyles there. So you have a very stratified social situation in Moscow and St. Petersburg. But, you know, one can always hope, and that's what I hope for. I guess my hopes were in vain. I don't know. But I would hope that we would not get into a situation in which we're going to be firing missiles into Syria, because that's the last thing we need right now, in my opinion.
What does it accomplish?
It just blows up more people, and, you know, of course, Assad is supposedly using chemical weapons and that type thing, and, of course, he's the modern-day version of Chemical Ali.
And see, I just got a tweet in from Isaac, Jim. He says, it's headlined, Putin to Cameron, no evidence Syria chemical weapons attack even took place.
Well, there you go. I mean, you know, he's going to say one thing, somebody else is going to say another, and unless there's some type of bridge of communication between people in which we can walk, it's going to be a sorry situation for the world. I mean, we have so many other problems that are confronting us right now. We certainly don't need another Iraq and Syria, and we don't need to have any type of thing like that, because we saw what was accomplished in those wars. Nothing at all. Just a lot of bad outcomes in terms of humanity and also politics and destabilization. And the Middle East is an extremely volatile place anyway. It doesn't need a whole lot to really send that whole thing going.
Well, I'm looking at this story that Isaac tweeted, Jim. I think you might find this interesting. The headline, Putin to Cameron, no evidence Syria chemical weapons attack took place, naturally comes from the RT website. But what I find fascinating is the way, I mean, this reads like something out of TASS or Pravda or whatever, you know, back in the day.
I was just thinking about white TASS and red TASS. Remember that?
Yeah. Let's see. Russia has no evidence of whether a chemical weapons attack has taken place in Syria or who is responsible. Russian President Vladimir Putin told British Prime Minister David Cameron in a telephone call, according to Cameron's official website. Okay, that's fairly straightforward. Mm-hmm. The two leaders had an urgent phone call on... We haven't gotten to the real old-style Soviet stuff yet. The two leaders had an urgent phone call on Monday afternoon regarding the Syrian crisis in the wake of a sniper attack on UN chemical inspectors outside Damascus, which happened. Mm-hmm. Following the call, the British government spokesperson said President Putin said that they did not have evidence of whether a chemical weapons attack had taken place or who was responsible, which is a far cry from the headline, which says it didn't happen. Cameron stated that he was sure the alleged attack was instigated by the Syrian President Bashar Assad's government forces, saying that he believed the opposition did not have the capacity to carry out such a strike. And after that, both national leaders reaffirmed the stance that all G8 attendees took in June. No one should use chemical weapons. And any use would merit a serious response from the international community.
Well,
and so they show up. They show up to do their inspection a day late and a dollar short. After the sites have probably been scrubbed clean, and get sniped at on the way. At which point they had to turn around and go back, you know, to their checkpoint.
I just wondered exactly how you could scrub something like that clean, you know? Use chemical weapons. I mean, you just don't use them today and they're gone, and the effects of them are gone tomorrow. That's for damn sure.
And the video, I don't know if you saw it, was both horrifying and compelling.
Unfortunately, it's easy to say, no, we didn't do it, and just take that type of stance. And that's, of course, a public stance. But like I said, I think the only solution to this thing is a back channel with Putin. And I don't know what's going on between Washington and Moscow right now. I mean, for a while there, we were, you know, on fairly stable terms. Not greatly stable, not as I would like for them to be. But, you know, it would appear to me if there was some type of detente or rapprochement between the two.
Well, I think, Jim, frankly, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, I think the argument can be made that there was an air of stability during the regime of Dim Leader, because Vladimir Putin knew that George was dumber than a post turtle, and basically had his way with him anytime he needed.
There could be a reaction to that, because, I mean, I think Putin realized that Dim Leader was just crazy enough to do just about anything in the world. And Russian leaders, I'm afraid, have a habit of respecting, they measure or have measured, and I'm not, you know, trying to be obtuse here, but they have a way of measuring the credibility of their enemies or their
opponents
or whatever in terms of military force and that type of thing. I mean, that has always been a trademark of the Russian government. I mean, for example, like even with Stalin, when he was dealing with Allied powers in Yalta and at Tehran, Stalin was extremely clever. And on this thing that I mentioned earlier in your email about the three-part series on Churchill last night, they brought out how Stalin had really tricked not Roosevelt, but Churchill. And, you know, most people believe it was because Stalin was the one who tricked Roosevelt because of Roosevelt's physical condition at both of these meetings, particularly Yalta, just 2 months before he died. But, you know, Stalin was just very crafty and had promised all these things to Churchill, and Churchill, I think, had bought up on it. And so it was the joke was on Churchill, played by Joe Stalin. And, of course, the only thing that Joseph Stalin was interested in was absorbing as much territory as he possibly could to serve as a buffer. And, of course, you know, the Russians have always been land sailors. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. And I was going to ask you a question a minute ago in terms of just trying to understand the context behind all of this.
I hope I can answer it.
Well, which czar freed the serfs and when?
It was Alexander II. Who freed the serfs, and it was about 1881, and in response to his freeing of the serfs and trying to reform that system, that he had just issued the manifesto doing so when he was driving back in his carriage to the Winter Palace when Atticus, who was like the daughter of the Governor General of Moscow, if I'm not mistaken, someone can correct me on that, was part of a plot to throw a bomb in his carriage. And of course the first bomb didn't hurt him at all, and he got out to see, you know, exactly what had happened to his entourage. He was concerned about them. He was a decent human being. He was a good man. And he said, thank God. And one of the other anarchists who was there said, it's too early for you to thank God. And of course Alexander II was taken back to the palace with one leg blown off. And of course, there in the presence of his son, Alexander III, died of exsanguination. And the bomb, you know, was, and they really got something for that, because under Alexander III, that was all it took for him to be one of the more reactionary of the Romanovs. And you really can't blame him. I mean, the guy had tried to do well, and you know, Bob, they always try to kill the people who try to make things or ameliorate a situation. They always do that. It seems to me that all the men in history, a lot of them who've been assassinated, whether it was Tsar Alexander II or President John Kennedy or Dr. King, the ones who...
Lincoln, Bobby, Malcolm and all, Gandhi... And all the way back to Caesar.
They always try to kill the ones who try to make things better. They always do. And they're always the victims of assassination. And that's just, for me, it's heartrending. It really is. Because when you think of what would have happened had these men lived, how much better things would have, how much better the developments would have been. But unfortunately, they didn't live, and of course, more arcane forces developed in their wake,
and let's not leave Yitzhak Rabin out of that list.
Yeah, no, you can't.
The man who said the history of humanity is written in blood, and it's time for us to find a different color ink. But the reason I asked about when the serfs were freed, we're basically talking about the transition from feudalism to so-called modernity.
It was a cumbersome system that he engineered.
But I mean, in the space of you get the freeing of the serfs, then you get the within what 25 years you have those stirrings of the Battleship Potemkin event?
Yeah, absolutely.
And 7 years after that, you've got the October Revolution. And so I think if we're just going to talk about the grand scheme of things, we need to have at least a working understanding that Russia has had a far, and I don't mean this derogatorily, Jim, I want you to understand it. Russia has had a far steeper learning curve than Western Europe or the nations that were spawned by it.
Bob, how many times have I said that on this program? Remember when I talked to you about meeting Yevtushenko? And I don't know what's become of him, whether he's still around or not. But he even, in one of his poems, he talked about Russia had been invaded by the Swedes, X number of people. But he said, but the most terrible of all have been our own people, referring to their own leaders.
And through the even grander march of history, Jim, I forget where I first read it, but I think it was our buddy Eugene Finnerman who, with all of his vast storehouse of knowledge of the Byzantine Empire, inspired me to go and read a little bit. And that fascinating parade of internecine rivalries and blindings and bloodlettings and murders and walling people up and everything that winds up in 1453, with the host of an entirely different Muhammad finally breaching the walls of Constantinople. It has never been lost upon me that the double eagle of the Tsar, you know, that symbol.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Is the same double eagle of the Byzantine Empire, which of course was Rome. I mean, people didn't think of themselves as Byzantine; they called themselves Roman. The Byzantine Empire had a Senate that was the same thing as the Roman Senate. So it's basically a historical panoply that extends from Ab Urbe Condita 753 before the current era through the founding of Constantinople, named of course after Constantine, which finally falls apart in 1453 of the current era. I mean, we're talking about a load of time now, and winds up going upstream.
But you see,
settling in Moscow as the Tsars.
Well, you see, Moscow became the third Rome.
Yeah.
Because of the,
I mean, there is an unbroken line that extends from 753 BCE in Rome to basically October 1917 in Moscow, because the civilizing influence as the Byzantines fell apart and lost their possessions in the Middle East, whether it be Anatolia or part south, they expanded to the extent possible northward, and eventually found, you know, it was Greek monks out of Byzantine monasteries and Greek Orthodox monasteries that wound up going north. And I know you know this, and among other things, crafting the Cyrillic alphabet for the Russian language.
Right. Exactly.
And the early Russians, the tribesmen, became the somewhat attenuated heirs to what was left of Byzantium.
Well, I think the story runs that, you know, when they established the Russian Orthodox Church, that I think it could have been Ivan the Terrible. It was one of the Ivans, probably Ivan the Terrible, or it could have been Ivan Kalita, old Moneybags, but anyway, Ivan the Fourth, I think, even sent forth emissaries as to which would be the best religion for the state religion of Russia. And of course, they went to Rome, and they went to other places, and like, for example, even to the Arabian states, even to Mecca or whatever. And it was decided that because of the nature of the Orthodox faith, that it would be the most compatible. It would be subservient to the state. I mean, for example, if you look at Russian churches today, as opposed to Western cathedrals, you will see in the Western cathedral these huge spires that reach toward God, right? But the Russian churches, they were content to make them very small, and, you know, with the onion dome cupola and the pendentive that architects made that possible with, that they were able to ask God to come down to them. That was the philosophy of the architecture there. I mean, we talk about dancing with architecture. This is one time a week you wouldn't have a very nice a waltz with architecture. But that's even embodied in the structure of the Russian Orthodox churches, which are just really just, in my opinion, are just as beautiful, if not more so, than the Western ones, you know?
Yeah,
my personal opinion.
No, it's a beautiful architecture, and it's more, frankly, you can make the argument that it is more organic within that cultural milieu than, say, the palace of St. Petersburg, because, you know, those were based on French models.
Right. I mean, this is one thing that the Russian Tsars had. They had one motto, and that was "Chercher le capable," look for the capable. And that began under Peter the Great, because he realized how backward his country was, and he realized that he would have to bring it not walking, but he had to drag it in.
Kicking and screaming.
Absolutely. I mean, St. Petersburg was a city referred to as the one built on bones, because what was St. Petersburg? Originally, it was in a worse type of climatic and geographic condition for a large city than Washington.
It was a swamp.
It was the swamp.
And one doesn't often think of semi-Arctic swamps, but they are a very real thing.
Exactly. And you, the people who died building that city, is just incredible. I mean, it is truly a European city. It is truly a hero city, in my opinion, when one considers the expenditures that were exhausted among its residents and its construction, and also its siege during the Second World War. It is truly a hero city. I mean, if you're going to have something bad come out of something good, I think they did a pretty good job with building St. Petersburg. And, you know, Peter wasn't the kind of person who took no for an answer. I mean, this guy was very far-reaching, and he was, you know, a very hands-on type of czar. I mean, he would get in there and build the ships himself, and he would get in there and learn the trades and stuff like that. And even, you know, he was interested in dentistry and stuff like that. If you don't believe it, be one of his courtiers. And, well, if you were one of his courtiers, you'd best not complain around him if you had a toothache, because he'd be the first to be over there with player pyres and wrench it out. He was quite a character. And strange enough, his death resulted from his efforts to try to rescue a drowned seaman. And it was in 1725 when he jumped overboard and, of course, developed pneumonia and died. But he was extremely far-reaching. And, of course, you had his successors, for example, like Catherine. I mean, a lot of people talk about Catherine the Great and some of her amours and things like that. But she was a very intelligent woman who came from just nothing to being dragged into the Russian court, which was terrible, and finally they had to kill her husband, who liked to do nothing but play with ships and things like that, Peter the Third. They had to kill him. But Catherine was also a woman who I admired greatly. I can remember when I was in the fifth grade, all these kids were talking about George Washington and our leaders, and of course this, your humble narrator, was the one who always was asked, you know, who do you think is the greatest? And I would not answer George Washington, but I would mention Peter the Great or Catherine, and, you know, be sent to the cloakroom, you know? I guess it's hard to believe that, but, and I don't know where I got that from. I think I got that basically from my father, you know, who measured terms of, you know, there's, of greatness. And, you know, Bob, wherever there is greatness, there's always, unfortunately, mistakes. There's always inhumanity, but the results are the same. The end, in certain cases, I guess, justify the means.
So I guess my question, Jim, then, is to what extent does that long and storied past explain the conduct of a Putin?
It's just as natural for Putin to use any method at his disposal as it was for any of the czars. For example, like Nicholas I, the grandfather of Nicholas II, the engineers were asked about a railroad between St. Petersburg and Moscow, and they were arguing about it. And he was in his study, and he overheard them in the anteroom, and he went in there and said, "What's the problem, gentlemen?" And they told him, and he said, "I'll solve it." He took a ruler and drew a straight line. He said, "That's where it's going to go. Period. End of story." And the railroad track between St. Petersburg and Moscow is the straightest in the world. There are no curves.
I'll be damned.
I mean, that's exactly the way Nicholas I, he was the gendarme of Europe, you know. He was a pretty tough fella. But, you know, strangely, under his tutelage, one of the greatest poets in the world flourished until he was killed in a duel, and that was Alexander Pushkin.
I was about to ask if it was Pushkin.
And it was strange enough that Peter the Great had imported people from all over, and the ancestor of Alexander Pushkin came from Ethiopia. He was black.
I had no idea.
He was an engineer for Peter the Great. And I've seen this. If you go to Pushkin, it was Tsarskoye Selo, about 15 clicks out of the city. It was formerly Tsarskoye Selo, and now it's called Pushkin Selo. But there on Pushkin's desk is a paperweight, and it shows a black man holding up a cotton bale.
Be damned.
And he was called the Lord Byron of Russia. And he wrote some of the most beautiful poetry in the world. And, you know, the Russians have been such distinct admirers of their writers, their poets, and their people like that. I mean, even when their country was invaded by the Nazis, they did the best they possibly could to preserve everything possible that was in their heritage. And they did. And if this country, for example, would be to have invaded by a foreign power, I just wonder how much effort we would make to preserve the homes and the dwelling places of former writers. But, you know, that's just, the Russians are very complex people. They're finding themselves, and I am the champion. I always have been. And because of their literature, their art, their culture, and, if you ask people in this country who Alexander Pushkin was, I don't think you find many people who know. But to the Russian people, he's an absolute hero and just an incredibly important writer, not to mention the other writers that came out of that period, the Golden Age and the Silver Age, and Tolstoy and these people. And their composers, for example, like Tchaikovsky. I mean, whenever you see the celebration on the Mall at the 4th of July, who do they play? Tchaikovsky but, you know, the words of that song are God Save the Tsar. They have nothing to do with American history at all. And I've taken too much of your time. I'm sorry.
No, but this is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Jim, I thank you very much.
Well, this has been one of our better talks, and I've enjoyed it tremendously.
As have I. You take care, Jim.
Okay, you too.
Bye. God, I love history. Thanks, Jim. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Mark the Marine.
How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great, Bob. I love listening to the first two callers. The gentleman from Ohio, the jazz player, he knows his military history. Something about Syria, I would just share with any of the listeners that are still listening to us. Al Stewart, a Scottish composer, and I was getting my ass kicked in San Diego at Camp Pendleton, and I was digging what the Marine Corps calls a fighting position. The U.S. Army calls it a foxhole. The Marine Corps has, sea bags, and the Army has duffel bags. It's a matter of psychology.
Sure.
A lot of psychology involved. And somehow or another, Al Stewart's song had leaked its way through. It was kind of like Full Metal Jacket, but out in the sun. And Al Stewart was in the background. I could have dug a hole to China that day. I was listening to it on a speaker, and my drill instructor was a big, tough son of a bitch. Looked like a combination of Clint Eastwood and Peter Fonda. Son of a bitch was 40 years old, Bob, could do 20 dead arm hang pull-ups without what the Marines call kipping. He was a decorated combat veteran from Vietnam. I would just like to say about Syria, let's take a look at things realistically. We have democracy breaking out possibly in Egypt. We have the Muslim Brotherhood and a little bit of a limbo. We have the Saudi Arabians that are precariously perched. We have the Russians with the jackass dictator through stolen elections like George Bush Jr., who has his people suppressed. So I think it's time we knock that little son of a bitch in the mouth and we show some true democratic leadership. And when the jackass from Syria, the dentist or doctor or whatever the hell he is, who stumbled his way into his leadership dictatorship, he has gassed women and children. I know they've shown that, and I know the Jews control what Americans see in corporate-controlled media. And that's a racist comment, but it's probably a goddamn fact. But the point is, I don't think that that amount of people could stage a death toll amongst themselves. So it might be time for President Obama, who knows all the facts, who has some highly decorated two war generals, and I talk about real wars like Vietnam, four people. Chuck Hagel, shot in the stomach. He has some Marine Corps people. I'm not a pacifist, Bob, and I am very much a veteran for peace. But I think it's right now a time with John Kerry, with his wisdom and his combat experiences, where the U.S. State Department has declared, yes, they have used these chemical weapons. Now, I know things could be manipulated, but it's just like the criticism we give Snowden. Snowden runs to Russia, and he trusts them more, so should we trust their bullshit propaganda themselves? I don't trust it in the least,
Mark. I don't like to interrupt folks or anything, but I got to push back a little bit on the whole Jews control the media thing. Corporations control the media, Mark.
But mine was a limp-sided comment by that. I was trying to elicit a response, and I apologize to you personally, Bob.
Well, no. I mean, if that was sarcasm, I understand it, because that's the way the right wing, the Birchers and the Klan, and it's Jewish. For 1,000 years, it's been Jewish bankers, and in the 20th and 21st century, it's the Jewish-controlled media. Richard Nixon was in the Oval Office moaning to Billy Graham about all the Jews. Billy, they control the Jews control Hollywood. You know,
Nixon was a bad Quaker,
and anytime I hear a remark like that, Mark, I mean,
I apologize.
Nobody will ever successfully call me a Zionist. Okay, I have horrible problems with the state of Israel, but it is not. Right. But it's not an ethnic or a racial problem. It's a pariah rogue state problem.
Well, can we say this to each other? And I'm not trying to elicit you to support war, Bob. And I wasn't saying that comment to you. It's just from the matter of time we have left in the show. And I apologize for my lack of. It's funny. One of the guys in the Marine Corps was a face in the Union. May have occurred today for me, but so I stand damaged, but because of the heat where I'm currently located, but they can't beat me, and I have love and respect for the Scots who have done much of the fighting for the British, and I'm not eliciting communist right, and what people, the poor civilians that write on Facebook, one of the mistakes they're making, we're going to war, was really a war. Their concept of a lack of reality, just like Jim said from Alabama, the gentleman, the Air Force guy, he's so smart, like yourself, you can tell he must have been an intelligence. My point is, there's a time to hit somebody right in the mouth, right in the jaw, in the mouth, but in the jaw. And I'm not hoping for that.
I understand that, Mark, but my problem is when... is when the question of who you ought to punch in the mouth is not clearly delineated, and we wind up it's like being in a bar fight and throwing a punch. You don't know if you're actually punching the guy who's trying to get somebody off your back, or if you're punching the guy who's trying to do you harm. And I'm sorry, but Syria to me just looks like a situation where we need to very, very conscientiously mind our own business.
Well. And of course oil is the subject, and I was listening earlier that the oil, though it may not be consumed by us, much of the Suez Canal, I would just remind the jazz man from Cleveland that Bechtel just built the last 10 years. This is why Obama shot down in Jacksonville about 6 weeks ago. Jacksonville, Florida, they're looking at trenching out the port there, and we're hoping from a union standpoint to be a project labor agreement, put a lot of people to work and living wage conditions. And the supertankers is what we're talking about. And though the Suez Canal was larger, I don't know about, I'm not trying to provoke. My point is the supertankers through the Panama Canal, and I'm familiar with Lake Nicaragua. I'm familiar with not geography. I know the Japanese wanted to do that, but my point is there, many things are connected. I don't stand for arbitrary violence. But to see this, I think our timing may sustain a democratic movement in Egypt, to some degree. It will shut the Putin Russians up, which they're not very powerful. I think there's a democratic volume there. I think they need. I think the world needs to see a righteous punch in the jaw, Bob. And I'm not asking for that. I'm a John F. Kennedy Democrat. He did not want to hit Brezhnev. He didn't want to hit those people. But he showed them strength through conviction. And I think that Obama has that capability, and he has people surrounding himself with those same devotions to strength and Americanism, and not arbitrary violence. And I'm very judicious.
And maybe that's the reason those frigates and guided missile cruisers are off the Levant right now. Maybe that's what. Maybe the show of force as opposed to the use of force.
Correct. They're stumbling in through language. You see, they're not stumbling, but they're. You see, these are coordinated. When they say something to the American public or the world, that means they've been there for 2 weeks. So you and I both want the same thing. I love Bobby Kennedy. I campaigned for him after they killed his brother John, and I think the Bush family is involved with that and the financing of Hitler. So, but this may be a time where we may have to clip somebody right in the goddamn jaw, which show that we still have some. But we don't want to appear to be desperate from an economic standpoint, because we know the Saudis have have a quarter of their economy in their Europe influenced banks, which goes back to the oil that which comes out of not only Syria but other parts of the Middle East. So much of the oil goes to there, and then we force them to buy our bad money here, and then blame it on socialism. So leadership sometimes leadership, even though it's ugly, sometimes you don't want to act like a drunken fool in a bar, but you quickly deduce the deductions and not always swing, but I think they are being judicious. But I think you can see this is being leaked out rather quickly, and something is underway. And I don't want boots on the ground from a personal standpoint as a boots on the ground veteran. I'm not that ignorant, but a couple of some strategic strikes. Not even going for the jackass dentist, but going towards some of his leadership and saying, "And we'll shoot to Putin with your little jackass horse riding whatever." Except that I am scared of their 3,000 missiles. But sometimes America needs to step up and lead through strength, and Obama has that leadership skill. That's all I can say.
I appreciate it, Mark. Thank you very much.
I'm with you in my heart, Bob. I want you to know that.
I understand that, and I'm just until it becomes utterly unavoidable, and sometimes even utterly unavoidable is a fluid term, Mark. I prefer, there's this everybody there's this notion in Sun Tzu's Art of War that says the best general is the one who manages to win without ever without ever doing battle. And it might be wise to go and revisit that statement.
Well, could I say in reflection of that comment that not only do I agree, but John F. Kennedy's lead military advisor, the Marine that suggested to him to avoid Vietnam was a Medal of Honor winner, and he worked for Smedley Butler in the 1920s in China, and it was about oil then. And he told John Kennedy, do not put boots on the ground. They shut him up. He wrote a book called 5 Minutes Till Midnight, and it was in strength of it was in reflection to the United Nations, suggesting that the United Nations was the only thing that kept the United States from being at war 24 hours a day, every day of the year. It was merely a speed bump, and that's what he said. That's a Medal of Honor winner from Tarawa. He's a native of Indiana. So, that's not all I'm going to say. I know you got to get going.
Yeah, I got to get out of here, Mark. We're 3 minutes till.
I want you to know that I respect your love for peace, Bob, and I'm still learning from civilians like yourself. I mean that in a complimentary fashion. But I still think that us John F. Kennedy Democrats that sometimes must tell the world that there is a sense of order, and it can't be manipulated by a little dumbass country like Israel or a little dumbass country like Beirut or wherever the influences come from. It must come from within, but it must make sense to a larger audience, and that's what I'm suggesting, Bob.
All right. Have a good night, Mark.
All right, bye.
Bye now. It is time to get out of here. We closed the program having raised $60 of the $300 that we needed. Thank you. Thank you all for that, and hopefully we'll get a little bit better by tomorrow. Quick note, closing things out. From Ron and Raleigh, subject line, Vlad. What people don't seem to understand is that Vladimir Putin has the mind of what he was and still is, an intelligence functionary. He is not a visionary thinker, nor is he a leader. He is at best a ruler, and by no means what Russia needs. Thank you, Ron. Thank you much. It is time to get out of here. Thank you all for the emails, for the calls. A couple of lines blinking, but sorry, time does not permit. We'll talk again tomorrow. Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net and ache.org. Perhaps tomorrow I'll talk a little bit about the weekend trip over to Cumberland, Maryland. It was a wonderful evening among people of very good will. Thanks. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.